Well, I'm happy to see so many of you have survived. We have an interesting subject this morning that comes down to the daily living of the things we believe. I've often heard people give very eloquent discussions on principles and ideals, but many of them are still in trouble themselves. They are unable to escape from habit patterns and from the traditional backgrounds from which we have all come in one way or another. I suppose that the present generation is one of the most complicated in the history of humanity. Not only is it complicated because of the rapid advancements in various fields of scientific progress, but it is complicated by a general revolution against tradition. Most people are blaming tradition for the conditions that they are in today. They feel that in some way we were prevented from growing in the very early years of our culture. Actually, however, most of the traditions which have survived have some foundation in facts. And facts do not change easily or readily or quickly. And our general background of tradition is essentially idealistic. This means that a percentage of people had strong convictions and lived by them, or tried to. This does not mean that all nations were contrite and honorable. It does not follow that all people have ever united in any constructive enterprise. But there was an undercurrent, a foundation of integrities, which this foundation is, at this time especially, unpleasant to contemplate. We do not want to reestablish the foundations of survival. We do not believe any longer in the golden rule. We talk about it, we write about it, but when it comes in conflict with personal interests, we forget the traditional integrity that is at the basis of our civilization. Nearly every great teacher of the past has brought us a traditional integrity. They have all done their best to call to our attention the realities of values. In most instances, some listened to them. In many cases, they were persecuted and martyred. But out of it all came a lingering stream of ideals that simply refused to die. And these ideals were the integrities upon which modern life has been built. But integrities often interfere with selfishness. They interfere with being exactly as free as we want to be. We were willing to fight and struggle desperately to get physical freedom, and most persons have achieved a considerable degree of it. But this personal freedom has not been brought under the censorship of integrities. We feel that we can do anything we want to, but we do not curb, integrate, or educate the desire structure within ourselves. So today, we are confronted by a complicated situation that is disturbing and frightening millions of human beings. According to some late statistics which we have received, the world this year has increased its population by 82 million. Looking forward into the future at a situation of this kind is very disturbing, because every year where populations increase, sacrifices must be made in order to maintain this increased population. Each individual has to work a little harder, gain a little less, give a little more, and be more patient than he ever was before. he is also going to find continual encroachments upon all the materialistic values that he has become accustomed to. The greater the population, the more each individual must give up personal ambitions. If he does not, the entire structure will fall apart. Everyone today is a little bit disturbed, some very much disturbed, by the complete collapse of our social system as we know it, the failure of our political system, the disabilities of our economic structure, and the continual danger to the personal life of the individual. So out of this comes anxiety, a continually increasing negative approach to circumstances. Today there are probably more worriers than ever before in history. Of course, this is partly due to the fact there are more people than ever before in history. But the percentage of worriers is increasing every day. There's hardly a day go by in which individuals do not come face to face with what to them is solid proof of the failure of their system of life. This is something that is bound to cause anxiety. But we have to also realize that these happenings are not accidents. The problems we face are the problems we have caused. And the fact that they were caused by our ancestors, and that we may leave them to our descendants, these do not alter the basic fact that man is the cause of his own trouble. Trying to work with this situation tells us very simply that the only cure for the problems that man causes is that man stop causing them. He must in some way change his own approach to existence. Of course, the first thing that comes to mind with this idea is that we must elect someone to do this for us. We must appoint someone to think for us and to have the authority to help other people to see the light and at the same time leave our private interests alone. These must not be disturbed. So we have today a tremendous desire for some heroic personality. We would like to see the skies open and the Holy Trinity take flesh. As this is highly unlikely, we have still other problems and ways of approaching this situation. Admitting that we are living in the day of the great headache, the question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we just simply going to have one headache after another as long as we live? Now, headaches due to worry, anxiety, misunderstanding, misinterpretation, antagonisms of all kinds, these headaches, unfortunately, do not stay in the head. They come out into other areas of our lives. This headache that we have, this grand head problem that worries us, is affecting every aspect of society. The worrier is already on the way toward being sick. Now, if worry was what was intended, it would be unlikely that it would cause illness and be destructive to the human being. We must therefore assume that worry is not the answer. Worry is only a means of complicating the difficulty. So the problem of going around worrying, fretting, stewing, fearing everything that happens, mistrusting everyone, and in a state of perpetual criticism, this apparently is not the answer. The proof of that is that it is solving nothing and making us sick. Therefore, we should begin to think in terms of how to act so that we will not be sick. The solution to the problem lies not only in our fears and anxieties, but in the solution of the causes of these fears and anxieties. It is useless to assume that the rest of humanity will agree with us on any subject. In fact, it's hardly worthwhile trying to convert other people. For just as surely as we are trying to convert them, they are determined to convert us. So it just goes on and on and on. The only way we can stop worrying, stop fearing, stop hating, is to put a discipline upon ourselves. We cannot prevent the world from worrying, but we can become detached from the worrying set. We can become self-sufficient to our own needs. This does not mean selfishness. It does not mean that we are not mindful of the problems of other people. It does not mean that we will not do everything possible to assist others in the solution of their problems. But it means that before we help other people, we must find an answer that will work for ourselves. There is really no use in simply sharing the worries. There is no use in trying to find new worries in everything that happens in life. Now, man has been given a faculty that is probably unique in the world of nature. He has memory, a magnificent equipment that enables him to build his own solutions by remembrances of his own life. History is collective memory. Biography is individual memory. An autobiography is the individual remembering the life he himself is living. Now, from the most fundamental and basic experiences of his life, he has been given the equipment to estimate values, weigh all things, and cling to that which is good. In order to do these things, he must shift his point of security. Everyone wants security. Insecurity is the great measure of our time. It is the problem that we are all concerned with. How can we find security? Well, it's obvious that the various patterns we are now following, these are not bringing security. The individual today is trying to find his securities where it is not, where these securities have no factual existence. One of the most basic problems here is the emphasis upon wealth. Most people are still convinced that if they have enough money, they are safe. Of course, it much depends on what they do with the money. If they take it to Las Vegas, they're not safe. Also, there are many investments which are very tempting and will lead to loss. But essentially, the individual feels that if his income and his economic status is secure, he has nothing to worry about. Facts are against this conclusion. For I've known a great many wealthy persons, and probably most of you have also known many who are more than comfortably fixed, who are worrying worse than anyone else. They're worrying because their wealth has been destroying their children, breaking down their homes, and making themselves sick. So physical securities are not the answer. Physical security is good if it's available. But as a goal, as an answer to the eternal problem, it is a failure. In the first place, there is no way in which everyone can be rich. And as long as there are various levels of finance, there will be conflict. So money is not the answer to our problem of security. The next possibility seems to be intelligence. Can we, by some means or other, think our way out of this dilemma? Can the mind solve it? Well, the mind has been producing solutions since the dawn of time. But these solutions are interesting, fascinating, very tempting, and can completely take over the life of a person. But these solutions are not solutions. All the mentality that we've had in the world up to the present time has been unable to cope with war, with crime, or with poverty. The mind tries to find answers, but every answer the mind finds and tries to apply comes face to face with obstacles that the mind cannot solve. The truth of the matter is that the mind is an interesting, fascinating bit of equipment, but it cannot correct the present existing circumstances. Now, the mind has given us a wide area of sciences and philosophies with which to cope with life. The mind has made possible science, but science is not solving anything. Science gives us a cure for some minor ailment, perhaps, or even a major ailment, but in so doing hands to the world mechanisms which could destroy the entire human race. Science has a very great weakness, and that weakness is the failure of humanitarianism in the scientific program. Science is concerned with knowledge. It is using the mind to advance its own purposes. But when it comes to taking care of the widow and the fatherless, science is not a great success. Other fields of learning, the arts, are corrupted. All of the various elements of mental activity show problems. Philosophy in our generation is virtually non-existent. What we call philosophy is a higher intellectual materialism. Our modern philosophies are based not upon ideals, but upon material institutions. We send our young people to the universities, and they have the minds trained. They come back from the university, and within a few years, they're in trouble. Even while they're in school, they may be subjected to narcotics, alcoholism, and other corruptions. Therefore, education has not been able to keep its own campus clean. Therefore, there is some question about it being able to solve the problems of mankind. So individuals look in all directions to try to find some answer to this very pressing problem, this mass of problems arising from something that must have a solution in the individual. Man will never be confronted with a problem he cannot solve. But he may be confronted with problems he will not solve because the solutions are inconvenient. Therefore, we can come now to the next issue in the problem. What is there that the individual can cling to in this great stress of modern living? The first natural answer to this is religion. But religion also is at a very serious disadvantage. Religion presents us with abstract virtues. Religion provides us with a concept of an invisible causal universe beyond our perceptions. It also populates this universe with beings invisible to us. And the whole situation sums up in a very simple thought, namely, that religion deals with things we cannot see, and so-called materialism deals with things we can see. It is perfectly possible to see the house we are building. It is perfectly possible to count the shares of stock that we own. But it is not possible to actually, factually estimate the nature of the spiritual world in which we live. This world is shut from us because we do not possess the extrasensory perceptions necessary to make an invisible spiritual causal life visible and tangible to our common everyday living. This places all the advantage in the hands of the materialist. Whatever he is doing, you can see, he can see. The laboratories produce these experiments. So we have facts gathering all the time, more and more facts, and truths gradually disappearing. This means that there is a conflict between invisible principles and visible policies. And as long as this conflict exists, the individual is inevitably over-influenced by the material policies because he can see them, because they are working in his life, because they are directly the causes of his worries. They become the great entanglement, whereas the solution in principles and ideals, this solution remains elusive, intangible, and is greatly overlooked because it does not immediately
prove itself to our physical perceptions. So with this situation constantly undermining our faith, it is very easy to become more and more addicted to worry and less supported by principles which we cannot actually see. The result, of course, has been the gradual rise of a vast materialistic culture. In ancient times, man looking for an answer to things found no answer in the society around him. There was no safety in his own cave, nor was there safety in his relations with those in the caves around him. He was alone, he was struggling against unknown factors, and the material world was as yet an unsolved mystery. Therefore, because he knew very little about the physical universe, he still was able to cling to the spiritual integrities of his tribal beliefs. As he knew more and more about the material world, he became increasingly involved. It became a great mystery, a wonder. It became a challenge. And little by little, attention was focused upon physical circumstances and the possibility of altering them, the possibility of taking your neighbor's cave and adding it to yours, the possibility of accumulating wealth or taking it away from someone else who had accumulated it. All these things came as man's knowledge of material things increased. And little by little, religion was, we will say, transformed from a simple hope, a simple statement of the reality of things above material existence. Little by little, religion was theologized. It was theologized in order that it might have a form or a shape, a dimension or a proportion that man could experience with his sensory perceptions. He could not understand the magnificent divine universal house, the magnificent universe, which was the symbol of the divine power. So in order to make this invisible principle in some way tangible, mortals began to build great cathedrals, temples, shrines, mosques. They began to create visible symbols of the invisible truths. And persons who could not grasp the invisible principles gained gradually a sense of respect, regard, and admiration for the symbols of these principles, the systems of faith that came into the world. The person who could not even for a moment experience the divine presence felt something when he entered the cathedral. He found himself in the midst of a great beauty, a tremendous elevation of concept and consciousness. He found himself surrounded by symbols of holy living and holy thinking. And gradually, these symbols brought him to his knees. He became willing to accept the invisible in the symbols which it had projected from itself, and which man had fashioned as a means of protecting the worship of the deity which was his hope of salvation. So by degrees, religion became embodied. It took upon itself the shape and proportion of the world in which it functioned. There was one great philosopher of the past said, there is but one God, but he has been worshipped under 72 names. Now the 72 names began to get us into trouble also, because people began to believe that each name represented a different belief, where the differences were largely those of language and grammar. And actually, the same ideal abstract concept of deity was present in all religions. The important point is that gradually the world was filled with sanctuaries of faith. Some still stand, others are ruined. Some more will be built. On and on, a certain type of human being will gain the strength of worship by beholding the houses of his deities, beholding the works of other pious people as these works are exemplified in the stained glass windows and the mighty arches and spans of cathedrals, churches, and temples. So we have the interesting phenomenon of man trying to make invisible things visible and achieving to a degree. But this degree soon got him into another difficulty. These various institutions which he created for the purpose of inwardly experiencing the sublimity of God gradually became involved in various theological complications. And these complications attempted to standardize men's beliefs, to force them to accept certain doctrines or policies regardless of their own internal attitudes or concepts. Gradually, therefore, religion was transformed into theology, and the priests of antiquity became the theologians of later time. These were individuals who were very largely dogmatic. They served dogmatic beliefs. They served certain attitudes. They held certain convictions as inevitable and absolute. And gradually this descended to the time of the Universal Reformation, so to say, the religious rebellion, which brought an end to the medieval world. After the Reformation, religions in Christendom began to break up. More and more individual theologies came into existence. Sect after sect rose, each with its own peculiar concepts and beliefs. And these sects ever since have been locked, to a great degree at least, in an intense competitiveness, an infinite belief that they are right and that therefore others must bend to them. Well, this goes on until another something came along, and that was what we call the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Humanism. It was then gradually obvious that the public was resenting the dogmatics of theology and was therefore striving to liberate itself from the arbitrary doctrines which were supported only by theological institutions. These doctrines gradually came into conflict with human interests and attitudes. As a result of this conflict, we find finally the rise of science and the definite basic antagonism that developed between science and religion in all its forms. These various changes came to the individual, and in the 20th century find the individual himself without any solid psychological, religious, spiritual, or even scientific support. He comes into a world that is dominated by millions of persons, each with ideas of their own, which cannot be reconciled with the ideas of anyone else. Therefore, instead of having a solid unity upon which to build something, each individual is under the pressure of a common dissimilarity. Everyone is trying to do his thing in his own way, and very often at the expense of other people trying to do their thing. So here we are now in the closing years of the 20th century, and we are here with practically no solid foundation under anything. We are searching for various integrities, and it has been obvious for a long time that science is not going to solve the problem of man's salvation. If it is able to extend the length of life, as it may hope to do, it is only going to give the individual more years in which to be miserable, because it is not giving him any good reason for the life he has. It is not making his life here useful, happy, pleasant, and constructive. It goes on helping him to physically survive, but it does nothing to make his survival important or to make his survival useful to anyone. The idea that he is going to be remembered by his descendants is a vanity in itself, just as certainly as we do not, at this time at least, have any particular regard for our own ancestors. It is all a problem of floating on the surface of an unsolved mystery. And in this condition, many persons just simply give up. They thus see no longer any reason for anything. Yet within themselves they have the faculties necessary to discover the reasons for almost everything. But because of the traditional attitudes, because of the limitations of our educational system, and the corruptions of our economic and political structures, the individual has no moral support to try and improve himself. He feels that the only thing he can gain by going against the system is to end up unemployed. He does not find any solution to the needs of his own inner life. There are things he would like to do, but when he is actually given an opportunity to live according to the convictions he claims to have, these convictions soon fall apart. He says he would live better under better circumstances, but up to now, there have never been any circumstances sufficiently good to make the individual live well. He thinks he's going to. He thinks if his worries are taken from him, he'll be happy. So he has some of them taken from him, and now he's worrying because he hasn't got the worries. That's frightening him. He thinks he must be failing in some way if he doesn't realize the seriousness of the situation. All these problems sort of gang up on people. They are not really prepared to handle them. They've had no background of training. The education they have is virtually useful only to make a living, not to make a life. Actually, we need a complete shake-up of the entire system. But when we think of shake-up, we think of anarchy. We think of some despotism taking over, destroying our freedom, and forcing us into a state of discipline of some kind. Then we realize that this is also motivated by materialistic ambitions. We are not in a position to solve most of these situations. Now, one thing we have to learn to do, and that is to accept the complication as it is. We must stop dramatizing and emotionalizing it. We must simply say, this is it. This is the way it is. And in all probabilities, in most ways, it is going to stay this way for a while. And it's going to probably stay this way as long as we live. Therefore, we are going to be born into confusion. We're going to struggle with it for our period of embodiment, and we're going to leave the confusion behind when we go. We are not going to change all these things instantly. No matter how hard we try, we have our troubles in common, but our solutions must be individual. The only way we can face this complex is to gradually work out in ourselves an explanation of it, a reason for it, that is sufficiently strong to enable us to live reasonably well and at the same time have a strong living realization of spiritual integrities. Now, this sounds a very difficult thing. But after all, this new world in which we live is an amphitheater of natural phenomena. We are here in a world in which everything is lawful or unlawful. Everything is cataloged, classified, and controlled. While we cannot, for the moment perhaps, see the hand of God in the things that happen, we do know that there are universal laws that are immutable. We also know that in nature there are principles which prove beyond any doubt that a universal system does exist, and that this system has the means, the knowledge, the consciousness, the reality, to survive all of man's difficulties and also to transcend man's intentions to destroy the system of which he is a part. This system cannot be destroyed by man. This problem, having been more or less sensed, as we have to sense it, we then can say to ourselves, we're in a mess. Why? How are we going to get out of this mess? How are we going to achieve the things that are necessary? Are we going to achieve it by becoming completely discouraged and becoming alcoholics? Are we going to get any solution to anything by narcotics? Are we going to make our world better for ourselves and other people by simply walking out into the wilderness somewhere and leaving everything else behind? Can we fulfill our destiny by taking holy orders and vanishing into a religious retreat? Can we actually accomplish anything by walking up and down the street with a banner condemning other people? We have all these attitudes, but none of them actually does anything to solve the problems of our lives. Today we have more groups that are in activistic relationship with others, that are constantly parading, that are constantly objecting, and yet out of it all comes nothing but a great headache. Why? Because this is not the answer. It is not the way we were intended to do it. Until we get down to facts and realize what is necessary, there will be no answer. And when we get to the point where we appreciate the answer, we realize that all the misery we've had was well worthwhile. That it was the only way that nature could educate a wayward creation. That it is the only way that nature can bring back the prodigal children that it fashioned into realization of its wisdom and its love, is to allow these children to get into problems they cannot endure any longer, and to discover for once and for all that they cannot solve problems that are greater than themselves. If this begins to sort of trickle into our consciousness, then we begin to have the foundation, not a final solution, but a foundation that will enable us to live the days of our years in a comparative state of acceptance. Not an acceptance of the way things are, now, but an acceptance of the necessity that mankind must pass through certain experiences to outgrow his own ignorance. The individual, therefore, can reach a point in which he can live from day to day, observing, reflecting, thinking, feeling, studying, doing everything he possibly can to understand the reason for the situations as they are now. And if he becomes more and more concerned in finding reasons, he will gradually rescue his mental and emotional complex from futility, from the belief that everything is wrong, that there's no solution to anything, and that he was born simply to suffer and die. He does not have to have these negative thoughts. What he has to do, instead of giving up in despair, is accepting the challenge of personal change. He must make certain adjustments in himself. He must gradually release his energies from despair and despondency and focus them upon the understanding of life, the understanding of the way things must be and the way they should be, and the way they will be, regardless of what man does. If we can get to understand, therefore, that we are being disciplined, that the individual is being encouraged to correct his own mistakes and stop making other similar mistakes, he will then perhaps have more energy for solution. There's a lot of work to be done in this world. There is a great need of united effort, but nearly always despondency, neurosis, pessimism, all of these negative attitudes impoverish the resources of the person himself. When he finally centers his mind upon futility, he will find it everywhere. He will become more and more futile in everything that he does. He will become discouraged. He will believe firmly that this world is of no value, and if he gets despondent enough, he may even contemplate suicide. But with all this contemplation and all this negation, nothing has been accomplished except the disintegration of a personal existence. Taking this point as a basis, then, of something to do that is a different point of activity, the individual should begin to try to observe the working of universal law in the various occurrences of his life. He must begin to see reasons for things which he now regards as merely miseries. He must begin to realize that he lives in a world of lawful procedures and that he must abide by them. Now, on some levels, we're beginning to get a little wiser. But up as to now, it hasn't been considered a general improvement. One of the fields in which we seem to be getting a little smarter, at least, is nutrition. We have discovered, finally, what we should have known always, but which we didn't need to know until we broke the rules, namely that nutrition is a very important factor in life, that it cannot be ignored, that the individual who wishes to have better health must concentrate his attention upon learning how to have better health. He must study the problems of nutrition in himself. He must discover his own mistakes due to appetites. He must discover why he cannot do just what he pleases and at the same time maintain bodily health. So here we have come face to face with facts, and we're gradually beginning to face them with more or less conscious intelligence. Now, our mental life is also in constant need of nutritional education. What we take into the mind as a phase of our nutritional problem. If we take in the wrong thoughts, we're going to be just as bad off mentally and physically as we would be if we eat food that is improper to our needs. The individual can be allergic to attitudes, and everyone, more or less, is allergic to negative thinking. It will never help him, and it will almost certainly hurt him. Now, this doesn't mean he won't live through it. He may have negative thoughts all his life and pass the century mark, but he will simply have extended the period of disappointments, disillusionments, and disasters for himself. Therefore, with nutrition, a very factual thing, the individual has a mental life that needs to be disciplined and needs to be subject to the laws of mental nutrition. He breaks these laws every day in front of his television, or he breaks them every day in the various activities which he considers essential. He takes in a constant stream of bad food. He takes in food that is not only indigestible, but in many cases it is hopelessly poisonous. He does the same thing mentally and physically. If he takes in contaminated mental food, he is going to be sick. And most of the mental conditions of our society lead to a problem of contaminated thinking. Now, the person doesn't have to take this on. He can live in the midst of it, but he does not have to become contaminated.